What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Realpolitik. I am your host, Firas Mahdad, and today I wonder, what are we going to be talking about? Has anything changed? Has anything substantial happened in the region? Or in the world, really? Well, as you've probably guessed, yes, the Middle East war is back on. But I wanted to put it in a bit of a broader context, because the argument that I'm going to try to make to you is that the Iranians and the Russians are fighting the exact same war. And this war is basically now in a phase where it cannot stop until either the Iranians or the Russians are fully defeated, or the United States is pushed away from the vicinity of Russia and Iran. These are the only two possibilities here, which really point to this war, to these wars being much longer with no clear end in sight. Now, let's talk a little bit about the strikes that we have seen the Ukrainians conduct against Russia. What we're seeing the Ukrainians do is very seriously expand their ability to strike Russia's refining capacity and energy infrastructure. And they are just having at it in terms of attacking Russian refineries. Now, the Russians always have some fuel problems over the summer, and they often restrict their diesel exports in particular over the summer and have to import gasoline in order to address the fact that their refineries, although a lot of them are quite substantial, simply don't provide enough for the domestic market. But now, with repeated Ukrainian strikes on Russia, this is becoming a bigger and bigger problem. And maybe the Russians will solve it in a couple of months, maybe they won't. But essentially, the message that is being sent to the Russians is that you've got to push the Ukrainians much further away, and therefore you have to fight for a lot longer and gain a lot more territory for you to have any satisfactory victory conditions. When we spoke last week, I explained how the Russians would have to basically advance much further from the territories that they currently control and run into this wall of cities. Zaporozhye, Dnipro, Poltava, Pavlograd is there somewhere, Sumy, Chernihiv, and Kiev, in order to properly secure the eastern bank of the Dnieper, and then work their way towards Odessa for them to fully win the war militarily. And this is a years-long project. What we're seeing with the Ukrainians striking so much further in the depth of Russia, in regions like Moscow, St. Petersburg, sometimes even in Siberia, is that this isn't going to be enough for the Russians. And what they actually need is some kind of major political arrangement with the United States that simply pushes the United States away from Europe. And that is going to eventually require strikes on European countries, similar to how the Iranians are attacking Gulf countries, to force the United States out and to force the Gulf countries to cry uncle and say, we can no longer host American bases or be an enemy of Iran. We've got a compromise here. So this is the dynamic that's emerging. And the other dynamic that's emerging is a sort of total war on Russian shipping. So the Ukrainians have managed to attack maybe 90 Russian vessels, according to The Guardian, in the Sea of Azov. The Sea of Azov is here, and it's basically next to Russian oil export terminals that go from this strip of territory through the Kerch Strait and then onto the Black Sea to supply Russian clients with oil and gas. And this is really important for the Russians to supply places like Africa and previously Europe. So the fact that the Ukrainians are hitting this area quite hard means, again, that the Russians need to get to Odessa and go further in depth. And it also means that their shipping will remain vulnerable if countries like Romania and Bulgaria are activated, essentially, if they strike Europe. So the conditions that are being placed on Russia are quite horrible from a Russian perspective. And the question is, do they decide to escalate or do they decide not to escalate? Now, the Iranians are fighting the same exact war. The objective of the Iranian war is to push the United States away from the region and turn Iran into the regional hegemon over the Persian Gulf. As you all know, the United States has peppered this region with military bases. They've got 3 or 4 in Kuwait. They've got a base in Bahrain. They've got bases in Qatar. They have bases in the UAE. In Saudi Arabia, they have access to Saudi bases. In Jordan, they use multiple bases. In Oman, etc., etc. So what's happening for the Iranians is sort of something similar. So long as the United States remains deployed in this region and treats this region as essentially its own, the Iranians can never be safe. And they're fighting the United States with the objective of pushing the Americans away from this region and forcing them to withdraw, which is not going to be acceptable to the United States. Like, the American global empire insists on endless expansion, and it insists that its remit is global, not limited to American territory, and not even limited to the Western Hemisphere. Like, they're not bound by the Monroe Doctrine. The American empire is intended to be global because they believe this is the only way to maintain their primacy, and they believe that it is their primacy that provides peace to the world. This is the American empire. This is the American empire's idealistic conception of itself, shall we say. And now we're in this position where the war in the Middle East has fully reignited, and the Americans and the Iranians are exchanging blows. This latest escalation was mainly focused on the Iranian interpretation of Article 5 of the Islamabad Memorandum of Understanding. On, I believe, 17 June, the Iranians and the Americans, just to remind you, signed an MOU that was supposed to provide a pathway to peace, 60 days of negotiation, followed by some kind of new agreement. And the best case scenario always was that the can would be kicked down the road indefinitely, rather than the war restarting at the instigation of one side or the other. And if you read my website, Modad Geopolitics, I argued that the Iranians have a lot of reasons to restart the war, including the fact that American interceptors are low. There's just not enough interceptors for the United States. We are seeing that in Ukraine, that seems to have run out of Patriots and is getting slammed by Russian ballistic missiles a lot more effectively. And because the world economy is on the brink of a major collapse, as Trump himself said, I believe, a few weeks ago, when he said that in 4 weeks, if the war continues, the world would have run out of reserves. And that was said 4 weeks ago, you know? And to be fair, during those 4 weeks, there were some exports coming out of the Strait of Hormuz, but it was the continuation of these exports that was the problem. Because the oil was, or at least some of the exports were taking place using the southern corridor of the Strait of Hormuz, which hugs the coasts of the UAE and then Oman, and exits the Strait of Hormuz that way. Whereas what the Iranians wanted was to assure their control over the strait and to assure that the shipping would go through their preferred corridor, which goes kind of between these islands and then out of the strait. This wasn't happening. And this was a problem for the Iranians because the way that they read this clause was that it was the Islamic Republic of Iran that would manage the strait, because the MOU says the Islamic Republic of Iran will make arrangements for the safe passage of commercial vessels. The Americans read it as permission to reopen the strait. The Iranians read it as permission to control the strait. And this vagueness in diplomatic language is always kind of deliberate because it leaves both sides with options. You maintain a degree of ambiguity, which means that you can sell your interpretation to your own public at home. And if you have to break the agreement, you can rely on that ambiguity to justify your actions. So what was happening for the duration of the short-lived ceasefire following the MOU was that a lot of the shipping was going via Omani territorial waters rather than Iranian territorial waters. And it was going without coordination with the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps rather than happening with Iranian permission. And the Iranians want to set this precedent that if you go through the Strait of Hormuz, you have to get their permission, because that means that they can then turn around and say to the Gulf states, we are the ones who are guaranteeing your shipping and your security, not the United States. You should tell the Americans to leave. If, by contrast, the shipping is going through the Omani lane and bypassing Iranian waters and permission from the IRGC, that means that the Americans are acting as security guarantors. And we saw the Americans claiming that the ships that were going through were coordinated with them and they were happening under their protection, etc. So the fight that Russia is having with the United States via Ukraine and the fight that Iran is having directly with the United States has essentially the same theme, which is to force the United States away from the near abroad of a growing imperial power, Russia and Iran, and for that imperial power to feel safe from future American attacks. And it's not that they're not willing to work with the Americans. You see the story here coming out from the New York Times, basically reported by Clash Report, which is linked to Turkish intelligence. You see these guys saying that actually the Israelis were working with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the former president of Iran, to try to install him as an Iranian leader. Now, Ahmadinejad, if you go back in memory, he fell out with a bunch of the more religious elements with Iran because he was an Iranian nationalist before being an Islamic revolutionary. And this is a constant fight and a real fight within Iran. If you're an Iranian nationalist, you look at the map and you see that the Israelis and the Iranians don't have a border. They can reach an accommodation where the Iranians control Iraq, the Israelis build their greater Israel, and they together crush the Sunnis in Saudi Arabia, in Turkey, wherever they happen to be, by collaborating with each other. This was the policy that was under the Shah, and it was justified by the threat of Arab nationalism and by the threat of Sunni Islam. So we can't have that because of the religious sentiment in Iran and because of Israeli expansionism that is going into Lebanon and attacking the Shia in Lebanon in order to expand Israel's borders. So therefore, peace between the two sides is impossible right now. But Ahmadinejad clearly thought that it was a possibility. Anyway, I digress. Given the fight over control of Hormuz, given this conflict between Iran and the United States over pushing the United States away from its borders, and sorry, just to go into another digression, the same dynamic can be reached with Russia. The Russian ambition is not to take over all of Europe. The Russian ambition is to divide Europe between them and the United States in the same way that it had been divided in the Cold War. Like, it's the same idea. But the Americans and the Israelis insist on too much expansion. For these smaller powers, Iran and Russia, that expansion is a direct threat to them. You see the Atlantic Council putting out papers arguing that Russia should be partitioned. you see plans elaborated by the Israelis and the Americans as to how they're going to divide Iran into different countries. What should theoretically be a peaceful imperial coexistence is in fact impossible. So the Iranians restarted that war over the control over the Strait of Hormuz, and they initiated it by attacking a bunch of ships in the Strait of Hormuz in order to assert that they control that waterway. And things, you know, escalated a little bit, and then they calmed down because the Iranians went to visit Oman and they spoke about the possibility of sharing some control over the strait, with one direction having to pay fees if you go via the Omani waters, and the other one having not to pay fees if you go through Omani waters, and the other one, if you go through Iranian waters, having to pay. The Iranians said no, and instead what they did was that they launched a bunch of attacks on the region, including on Musandam. Musandam is this piece of territory here. It's a governorate within Oman. It's the territory of Oman that sits on the Strait of Hormuz. And if you look back, this territory became part of Oman because the British in 1970 decided that it should. It was Britain's way of maintaining an imperial toehold. And obviously, as with all British imperial possessions, it passed on to the Americans. And so the Iranians launched a series of attacks, including against Musandam. There are some reports that they hit the Wasit governorate, the middle governorate, which has this Dukum port inside it. Dukum port is intended to provide an alternative shipping route into the Gulf that bypasses Hormuz, and so the Iranians hit that right after having had some negotiations with the Omanis. The Iranians also hit a bunch of military bases in Kuwait, of course, and in Bahrain, and in Qatar, and in Jordan, but supposedly, they didn't hit Saudi Arabia. Now, we don't know if they hit Saudi Arabia, but it wasn't declared, or if they chose to keep the Saudis out of it for now. And we will talk about the Saudis and how they're going to get hit in a few minutes. So they hit all of these territories, but for me, some of the more interesting strikes happened in Kuwait. Because weirdly enough, the Iranians seem to have struck some border posts in Kuwait. And if you look at that, well, Kuwait is right across from Basra. It used to be called Kut al-Basra, the port of Basra, or the something of al-Basra. Basra being in Iraq, and Basra having a major concentration of Iraqi militias, and being right across from the border with Kuwait, you know, the Iraqis have always believed that Kuwait should be part of their territory. For the Iranians, this makes sense to want to expand into Kuwait, because from Kuwait you get to Basra and then you attack the major oil refining, the major oil facilities in Abadan, right across the border with Iraq. People forget how concentrated these assets are, that you have Basra and the oil export terminal here, you have Kuwait with the Ahmadi port and a huge oil export capacity there, and you have Abadan, which links to Kharg Island, which is where a lot of the Iranian exports happen. And this was obviously the scene of the Khurramshahr battle between Iraq and Iran, which, you know, was territory that the Iranians almost lost to the Iraqis before pushing them out. So you've got this long history in this region. And then you see the Iranians attacking border positions in Kuwait. Logically speaking, they have no chance of launching a ground attack against Kuwait, because the minute that they mobilize, they get slaughtered from the air. So I'm not sure what exactly it is that they're thinking. But they're doing it. And normally you do this kind of thing in advance of wanting to send some very suicidal ground troops. I don't know exactly what the Iranians are thinking. But the other thing that happened was that the Iranians also attacked some of the offshore facilities in Kuwait, some of the offshore oil extraction facilities in Kuwait. And if you look at the geography, it's ridiculously easy for the Iranians to fire drones into any Kuwaiti offshore assets. Kuwait doesn't produce a lot of offshore oil, however. It's not that important. Where offshore becomes insanely important is in Qatar, because you have here the North Dome field in Qatar, which is the same gas reservoir as the South Pars field in Iran. I want to show you these very large oil drilling rigs that are situated in the middle of the sea. This is where the Qataris get their gas. So the way that I read it was that the Iranians were sending a signal to the global market saying that, yeah, we can start lobbying one-way drones against these offshore facilities in Qatar. And if that happens, the Qataris won't be exporting oil exporting any gas for many, many years. So I thought it was interesting that the Iranians were playing their hand that way. And the Iranians are also hammering Bahrain, which, as you will remember, is 60-70% Shia. And they claim it as the 18th province of Iran and believe that it should be part of their territory. This obviously is the nightmare for Saudi Arabia, because Saudi oil comes from this region in the east of the country. And that has also got a pretty large and very unhappy Shia population. And if the Iranians get a toehold here in Bahrain, they can expand it into Saudi Arabia. So it looks like the Iranians are signaling that they're going to destroy Bahrain and Kuwait, as these are their way of surrounding Saudi Arabia and getting some ground options against Saudi Arabia. That's what it looks like to me. It doesn't mean that they can do this, because they don't have the capacity to just land troops into Bahrain. But if 60-70% of the population is on your side, and the government is broken and broke, and everybody, the ruling institutions are severely weakened, things look slightly different. If you enjoyed this preview, please consider subscribing to LotusEaters.com, starting for just £5 a month.
Hey everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com, get yourself a $30 coin pack for just $10.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.